Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsum a day for the 13th of Tammuz. 13th of Tammuz, we are going to study Rav Uziel's thoughts, the thoughts of Rav Ben Sion Meir Chai Uziel from Shut Mishpatei Uziel, the responsum Mishpatei Uziel, fourth volume of Choshen Mishpat section, Siman Gimel, the third responsum. It's about choosing communal leaders and who has the right to vote for such communal leaders. It's a tshuva, it's a responsum from the 13th of Tammuz of Tof Resh Tzadi Hei, which was 1935. And he's writing to the central leaders, the Hanhala, the administration of the Hapoel HaMizrahi, which was like a labor, religious Zionist party. And here's his basic answer to this question of who is it has the right, what is the Hanhala, what does the administration have the right to do? So first he says that the Hanhala of Inyanei HaTzibor, the administration of communal matters and making rules for communities and making new ordinances for communities, is done by, that it's done by elected officials. He says there's no doubt that it's true, that in many communities, he in fact says, the tradition was you had what were called Tuvei Ha'ir. So Tuvei Ha'ir were the leaders. They were like in a shul, the executive board. They were an executive body that ran the matters of that community. And Shekiblu Malehem HaTzibor, that the community had accepted them upon them. So Rav Uziel says they have halachically the power to make any ordinances that they find appropriate and necessary for the benefit of the city or the benefit of the community, depending on what they're in charge of. And they're thought of as a Beit Din B'Yisrael. They're thought of a Gadol. They're thought of like the Sanhedrin, in that the agreements they make and the ordinances they make obligate the entire community for all the things that that community, for all the powers that community has given to them. In other words, the Rav Uziel is saying that one traditional way of having a government was that the people agreed, however they agreed, and that we're going to get to, but in, it could be, and sometimes it was done by a claim, it could be it was the richest people in the community, whatever it was. However that top body became agreed upon, they had significant power. So let's say they said, we're making an assessment. If you think about a shul today, if a shul today were to make an assessment on its community, or even just a town, let's suppose that, you know, pick, let's say Houston, Texas comes to my mind, so for no good reason. Let's say there would be three shuls in Houston, Texas, and all three of those shuls, of the Orthodox shuls, got together, and they agreed that every Jewish member of an Orthodox shul, everybody who affiliates an Orthodox shul, who davens there, has to give $100 to X cause. So Rav Uziel is saying that becomes binding. Nowadays, nobody knows about that word binding. People don't think that it really is binding. But the answer is, to the extent that these people have been picked in the way that that community or that shul picks people to lead them, and these are among the enumerated powers of those people, then it becomes obligatory upon the members of the shul or the members of the community to follow what they have to say. His source for this is a halacha in Choshen Mishpat, in the second simon, in the second chapter of Choshen Mishpat of Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says that every Beit Din, every court, even if they don't have the traditional smicha, right? The traditional smicha gave many powers to courts that we no longer have. But even if this Beit Din does not have that power, does not have that smicha, imroim sheha'am prutzim ba'averot, if they see some issue where the populace is violating the Torah in some way, and there's some communal deed, the Torah had added, and there's a particular pressing time need of the time, they could do whatever they needed to do. They would judge capital punishment if they could. They could judge monetary issues. They could give any punishments they needed to do. And they could do it even if there's not a dut gemura, even if there's not full and complete testimony about it. Important sort of addition to the halachos. I think many of us know that Beit Din is supposed to operate in a certain way with two witnesses, the Torah says, and there has to be warning. And there's all these restrictions on how judgments can be passed and how we can decide who is or isn't guilty, is or isn't liable. But the Shulchan Aruch is saying that if a Beit Din sees a need of the time and the community has problems, and then they can come to conclusions even without that kind of full proper testimony. And then they say, and if the person who is the problem is an alam, is a particularly powerful person, so they have a problem, it's a challenge for them to bring him in line. He doesn't immediately yield to communal discipline. Shulchan Aruch says, we can go to non-Jewish authorities and have them punish this person or bring this person into line. And they can, the Shulchan Aruch says, confiscate money. They can destroy people's property, whatever they feel and see as necessary to help the generation improve and move better. As long as, and it's an important thing to remember, they have to be ma'asehem l'shem shemayim. They have to be doing it for the right motives. This is a lot of power, and we today are probably very leery of that. We today probably also know of examples and situations where, unfortunately, power like that has been wielded in inappropriate or improper or less than with less than the judgment and the perspicacity that we would hope for. And then the Shulchan Aruch adds, "V'dafka gadol hador otuve ha'ir shimchum beit din alehim." The people who have this power are those who are either really a giant of the generation or the leaders of a city, and that the court or somebody has made them the ones in charge. The Ramah adds there, the truth is that in every place you have this custom that you have tuve ha'ir, and the people in the city of the tuve ha'ir, the leaders of a particular city, they have the status of a beit din hagadol. They have a status of a major court. They can punish people, even flogging people, as long as the non-Jewish government, the secular government, allows for it. That's a dina de malchut, a dina issue. That's a requirement to follow the local authorities as well. But in terms of halacha, they have the power to do things that would ordinarily seem to be outside of their powers, and they can confiscate money according to whatever the custom is. Even though he says there are some who dispute this and say it's not true that the Tuve Ha'ir don't have these kinds of coercive powers, these kinds of punitive powers. All they can really do is whatever the custom has been until now, and they can only enforce current custom until now. Or if there's a unanimous, right, there is a strong trend before the Ramah's time, especially in Ashkenazic circles, to think that unanimity was required before the community could act in a certain way. Here too, if it's not an existing custom and they have it unanimously accepted it, there are those who held that that's all that they can, that's all the local Tuve Ha'ir can do. But they can't change things, even though they see that there's a need for it. If it's something that affects some people positively, but some people adversely, then they can't do it. And to confiscate money, again, there are those who hold that you have to have unanimity. But the Ramah says, but you follow the custom of the city. So if the custom of a city or of a community is to give the Tuve Ha'ir, the communal leaders, more power than that, then they have the more power than that, and then everybody has to follow it. And especially if they said, we'll accept whatever you say, and you just have the power over us. That's a very current issue. Rav Uziel is writing in 1935. He's going to talk about how we select people, but his first point is that leaders have much more power halakhically than we often today tend to give them, which would mean that if you're a member of a community and the leaders, the properly elected leaders of that community, within the powers that they have, make a decision, it means that it is halakhically incumbent upon all the members of that community to follow that decision. Now, they can maybe lobby to try to get leaders to change their mind. They can fulfill that obligation and then try to, you know, elect new leaders or get those leaders out of office. They can pay that obligation and then leave. But that obligation would seem to be the kind of thing that they're required to do just by virtue of the fact that in that case, the communal leaders were acting within their rights. The Rashba, Rav Uziel points out, adds the same idea in his tshuvot, in one of his responsa. He says, "Kol inyanei hatzibur, any of the issues that come before the community." So a part of the community doesn't have the right to do something about it without, the Rashba says, the unanimous agreement of the community as a whole. Again, that strand of Jewish thought that required unanimity, which makes it very difficult to run communities because unanimity is very hard to find, especially among Jews. Unless, he says, the people involved are mimunim al yinei hatzibur biklal. They are generally appointed to oversee the matters of the community, and all of the kihilot that the Rashba knows, all the communities of the Rashba knows, which select such people, meaning instead of having this unwieldy requirement for unanimity, they would select people, and then maybe that process was unanimous, but they would select people, and once those people were selected, they were vested with the authority to take certain communal actions, including to obligate people things. And then the Rashba says, and there are places where they choose Mukdamim, we don't need them, they give them the power. And in most of the places, it's the leaders of the community who agree on all of this, and they then run the community in the way that seems right to them. And the Rashba adds, and leave out the particular groups he's naming, but his point is that one of the reasons to do this is that one of the problems in trying for unanimity is that there are people who really have very little or no understanding of the issues, and therefore they will take a position that is counter the good health of everybody in the community. So that's a problem always, meaning, let's say, if you think about America today, there are Democrats and there are Republicans. There are well-thought Democrats, there are well-thought Republicans in general. I don't want to be political about this. My point is that there are plenty of disputes that come up in how best to run a country or a community or a city or a state among the well-thought-out people. But then there are people whose opinions, not that I disagree with their opinions, I don't mean that, it's their opinions are not based on anything rational or reasonable, and they have no real right to their opinion because they have no real expertise, they have no real experience, they have no real insight into the issue. And when you let those people have says in this, it can mess up, it can dirty the water, it can muddy the waters around the discussion. Rashba basically says that. He says, so in his example, one example is women. We can leave that aside. In his time, women weren't going to be of the kinds of people who were going to be able to weigh in intelligently because of the way the women of his time lived and were educated and thought, not our discussion. Ketanim, minors. Again, they're too young to really understand what's going on. Ulachalushe dat, and people who just aren't that. So, I don't know if it's a question of native intelligence. I think it's a question of galusha dat here would mean people who have not developed enough of understanding of the way the world works to have a meaningful understanding of the issues facing the community. So that's a rashba to keep in mind in terms of lots of issues. In Jewish communal affairs, it's a thing to think about. I certainly know of situations where I've been in various kinds of communities, and you have people weigh in, and you can have people weigh in on both sides, and you can have intelligent people weigh in on both sides, but then you can have people whose ideas are just don't even rise to the value of an idea. So the Rashba is saying one of the reasons to select communal leaders, invest them with the power and the authority to make decisions, is because they're the people who have some kind of reasonable expertise, some kind of reasonable insight, who can perhaps seek the opinions of others with insight, but don't have to try to strive for unanimity when many of the people who you have to appeal to when you're going for unanimity, their insight and their understanding simply doesn't rise to the value, to the level at which it's worthwhile to take them into account in that sense. That's a very hard set of statements because in democracies, very often we see it the other way. We think everybody has the right to an opinion. So right to an opinion in terms of saying that we're not going to dictate to them because we're afraid of the powers of dictators. That's the choice of democracy. But very often, it leads people to forget that that doesn't mean that the people who are being given this right to vote necessarily always have valid and worthwhile opinions. So that's how you know who is who is a hard question. Now, the Rashba doesn't say we know who is who. The Rashba just says by choosing a representative body, by choosing seven, by choosing a committee of people who we can trust and whose seriousness and sense of responsibility we can rely upon, that can avoid some of these issues. And he says we treat them mostly as what's called an apotrophos. So an apotrophos comes up in several contexts, but usually it's like a guardian or a conservator, an executor, somebody whose job it is to watch out for other people's interests, and that's how these people, these communal leaders, are going to be thought about to oversee all of the issues that come before the community. However, the Rashba continues, if a minority even of the community, even from those who don't have this insight that we would like, even those we might think of as being uneducated and unlearned and therefore really not understanding the issues, if they make a mechah, if they protest, unless they've already accepted these people upon them and they've given them the power, once they've vested the power, that's another issue. The question would be how they stop vesting that power. But once they've vested the power, but if they've not vested the power with those people, then the Tovei Ha'ir don't necessarily have the right to do these things because they can't, where do they get the right from? In other words, the Rashba is saying the right really originally rests with each and every individual in the community, and that's why unanimity was the original assumption. Since unanimity is unwieldy, the system of Tuvei Ha'ir came about, and the system of Tuvei Ha'ir is that however those people were chosen, they were then given authority, and then everybody had to follow that authority. That's good and not good. It's good in terms of things being able to get done, because you don't have to get unanimity from the rest of the populace, but it can happen, and unfortunately it does happen, that the Tuvei Ha'ir will make decisions that may be wrong, that's one problem, but also may simply ignore the interest, right? In American history we know this, that the founding fathers were worried both about the tyranny of the majority and the tyranny of the minority. So the tyranny of the majority is, let's say 70% of a community agrees about a certain course of action, 30% is a large section of a community, and for them to have their interests ignored and their claims ignored, that can be a problem. That's what the Rashba says, so that becomes an issue. Now Rav Uziel says, from from that Rashba, we can see that Tuvei Ha'ir are generally assumed to be the apotrophosei hatzipor, the ones who are given the right to look out for the interests of the community, and therefore they can make laws and ordinances, and they can administer all of the issues of the community as long as nobody lodges a protest. But once somebody lodges a protest, that will be a problem. Problem that we forget about today. I recently had conversations with people about that issue of making some mechanism for when a minority, a 25% minority, a relatively small minority, has a problem. You want to be able to take care of their concerns and their issues as well, and have some kind of a mechanism to recognize it. The Rashi was recognizing that, was dealing with that a little bit, and Rav Uziel is saying, but even that minority, if they've accepted this group as their leaders, then they become like a Beit Din, they become like a court for whatever it is that the community accepted them upon themselves for, and then their rules obligate all the members of the community. Another aspect of the issue to be stressed and to be repeated. As far as halakhically concerned, if there's an executive committee of whatever organization it is, and the members of the organization vested that executive committee, or whatever you call that committee, with certain powers, and they are wielding those powers given to them, and by wielding those powers given to them, they are obligated in certain ways, they obligate everybody in certain ways, that becomes an obligation upon everybody. So if Shul decided, the seven, whoever it is, the executive board decided the shul needed to do repairs, and that will take a special assessment of $500 from every member of the shul. So how you collect that always becomes a big issue. Part of what Rubiziel is pointing out is that if it's within the powers, the bylaw powers of the executive committee, then it's simply obligatory. By virtue of them just deciding, it shouldn't really be their responsibility to go out and get it. Everybody in the shul should feel obligated because that's the way it works. Now, it could be you'd want them to have a hearing process and think about the size of the issue and give a chance for people to weigh in, but fundamentally that's the halacha. As the Rashba said, that every community in his place, they would always do this. They would set up this Tuvei Ha'ir, these people, and they would make these kinds of ordinances. That means then that the elected leaders of a community have the status of a court in these kinds of things. Although it's true that generally we do it by the rove, by a majority, whichever has to do with Inyanei Torah. So in any place, including where there's a monetary issue, he says if it's got a Torah aspect to it, you'd also need the agreement of a chacham, meaning Rav Uziel is now saying that for all that we give them lots of powers, and the community can agree to give them lots of powers, whatever has to do with money, including confiscating money, there he thinks you need to have some kind of a Torah scholar who agrees or signs off on it to say this doesn't violate the Torah and this is within the Torah realm of what are acceptable ways to go. And that's based on another paragraph in Shulchan Aruch, where the Shulchan Aruch in Choshen Mishpat, Reish Lamed Aleph Chafchet, 231:20, paragraph 28, says that the members of a profession, this is harkening back to the guild system, which you no longer allow for, although you do have things like professional standards set up by professional communities. So that's something like this, that the members of a community, of a profession, the members of a trade or a craft, can make certain rules regarding their trade and craft. You can have that in medicine, you can have it in law, such as, this is the example the Shulchan Aruch gives, that they might decide to have different days of the week when each tradesman or craftsman will ply his trade. Nowadays, we wouldn't like that because we, in most capitalist countries, are leery of cartels, and we're leery of agreements like that because we think that that leads to driving up prices and less competition, and we think competition is a valuable thing. That's a whole set of discussions of the economic assumptions of halacha as opposed to the economic assumptions of the capitalist system, where we do and don't allow that, where they, how they meet and how we put them together. Not our conversation today, so we're not going to get into it, but that's what Shulchan Aruch says. And then, if they make that agreement, then anybody who violates it, they can punish that person financially. The Rama adds, that's when they make this takana kulam biyachad, all of them together, but if two or three of them just decide, then that's not going to be binding on anybody else. The Shulchan Aruch now says, when is all this true? That's when you don't have a chacham around who's got authority over the tzibur. But if you have a Torah scholar and a sage, then they're conditions, the rules they make can't have any, don't have any effect, and they can't punish people, and they can't cause people loss, unless they did it with the agreement of the Chacham, of the Torah scholar, meaning if all the cobblers, if all of the wagon drivers, right, all the taxi cab drivers wanted to make a rule for taxi cab drivers, whatever it would be, you can't work more than a 12-hour shift, right? No more than 12-hour shifts at a time, because we think that after 12 hours behind a cab, even with all the coffee in the world, even with taking, pulling over to the side of the road every 3 hours for a nap, you're not going to, after 12 hours, you can't drive safely. That's the rule that the cab community made. The Rama is saying they would have to consult with a Chacham and get the Chacham to sign off, the Torah scholar to sign off on that, and then it would have the full validity. But if there's a Chacham around and they need to, and their rules are going to have any kind of financial impact on other people, then they have to do it with the consultation of the Chacham. And the Rama adds, if there's not financial losses to anybody, then they can make the agreement even without the Torah scholar's agreement. So all of that is background, because the question that was being posed to Rav Uziel wasn't about the powers of the governing body, but he's enlightened us about the powers of a governing body, and that gives more oomph to the elections, because the elections are going to be giving fairly wide powers to the people who are elected. But this question is about the elections themselves, who has the right to vote, and who has the right to be elected, who's qualified for office. So the question would be, is it only people who pay their dues or their taxes or whatever it is, or maybe there's a special poll tax to, or an election tax for the right to be part of the election, or anybody who happens to live in that area? And that was really what the question was. So there, Rav Uziel answers that he thinks that the right to vote, zechut bechira aktivit upassivit b'hanalat hakilut, there's an active right to vote and a passive. So he says, all of the members of a city or of a community are like partners in terms of their various needs, in terms of making rules that apply to their needs and to all of their joint interests. And therefore, he says, all adults who pay taxes that are placed upon them have equal rights with all of the other residents to express an opinion when it comes to running the community, whether it's a community or a city or whatever the size of that community is. And that would mean the right to vote. It would mean the right to be elected, to be part of the Hanhala, part of, the, of whatever administration there is. And that's what the Mordechai had written even hundreds of years before Rav Uziel, that all the members of the city should see themselves as partners in all of the taxes. I'm not sure, nowadays it gets so big that we don't always remember that, but that's what we really are, and that's how we see ourselves, and therefore, we have the right to vote. And that's what the Rama says as well, he points out. There's another paragraph in Shulchan Aruch, in Choshen Mishpat, Kuf Samach Gimel, paragraph 1, Aleph, so 163.1, where the Choshen, where the Shulchan Aruch says, the members of a city have the right to coerce each other. And the Rabbeinu Yerucham says, even the minority can coerce the majority for certain needs that are well-established needs of a city. So those include building a wall, building gates for the wall, building a reinforced gate to close at night, to build a shul, because every city needs a shul, to buy a Sefer Torah, to buy Nevi'im and Ketuvim, right? To buy books of Jewish learning so that people can, to have a library in the shul, so that people can learn from it. And the Rama adds, and that's true of all of the needs of a city, and the members of the community can coerce each other to, he says, to extend a welcome to guests, meaning people happen to be in the community, to find ways to take care of them, to give out charity, and to give money to charity. So all of the communal needs that they, and then all the communal needs, sorry, that they can't agree about, and they can't decide who should give how much, then all the balabatim who pay taxes will accept upon themselves that they all say their opinions, what the Rama says, and then they'll follow the majority. And if the minority refuses, the majority can force them even to go, they can go to non-Jewish courts to get the non-Jewish authorities to force them to it. And if somebody who says, well, I'm not going to express my opinion, that doesn't count. Meaning somebody will say, well, you can't vote until I've had a chance to express my opinion. I'm refusing to express my opinion. That doesn't work, and you can ignore him at that point. In other words, and there's a lot of discussion about this in the Pirkei Tshuva, but the Rama's position was that the way communities should run is that they can force each other on various matters that affect all of them, although you're supposed to get the opinion of all of them and let everybody speak up. That is a possibility in smaller communities when there's 30 Jews in a city, 50 Jews in a city. Once it gets bigger than that, it becomes very unwieldy. I've been at meetings where you have everybody is given the right to speak, and they get up and speak. It takes hours and hours and hours, and it could be the community just doesn't have the time, and then you have to have other mechanisms put in place. But the fundamental idea is that everybody's opinion should count, and not that they all get necessarily a vote, but everybody should be count. And then the community has coercive powers to once it reaches its conclusion. So what counts as paying taxes, Roziel says? He says he thinks it means that it includes all tashlumim shitufiyim shech yachid mishtatif lefi arachato, any joint expense that all the members are required to pay according to their ability to play. So that would include, if you're going to, like a water tax, it would include sanitation fees, right? Nowadays, we just pay taxes and it all goes to everything. So whoever pays taxes is voting, it has the right to vote. But Fruziel is saying there are various needs, and unless you're paying all of them, then you wouldn't be a voting member. As long as there's a communal pot, a communal set of funds that's being used for those purposes, and the people who pay into that are the ones who have the right to vote. And therefore, Hilkach, Shurat Adin, the halacha should be that all the people pay those taxes, whether they pay a lot or a little, as long as they're paying the amount that's appropriate to come for them, they have a right to be included in choosing the Hanhala HaTziburit HaIroni, to choose the authorities, to choose the leaders of the community. And then he says, Bizchut Shaveh Umleya, with a full and equal right to do so. That's the way he says. That's Ikar Hadin, he says. Aval Mitzad HaTakana. But if you want to make things run even better, then the Tuvei Ha'ir, the leaders who have been chosen by the community, can make rules about that. And they can make decisions about who has full rights to vote. And they can say that people who have more money, let's say, or more education, or more insight, all of that, he thinks that they can make rules about, which in a democracy, we say exactly not that way, because we're worried, in American democracy, let's say, we're worried about the tyranny of whoever it may be. So if, you know, one time the Congress were to be taken over, or whoever makes laws for the you know, a local city council were to be taken over by intellectuals, and they would say only the people with PhDs have the right to vote. Right, so we're worried about that. Or they would be taken over by very wealthy people. And very wealthy people would say, well, we're the ones who understand how the world works. Only people with a net worth of, I don't know, $1 billion in the United States of America have the right to vote. Whatever it would be. Those are our anti-democratic steps. Ravuziel is not going that far, but he is saying that if the leaders of a community come to believe that there are reasons to limit the rights of voting, as long as they're doing it for the good of the community and so that peace should reign in the community, then he thinks they have the right to do that, and that's part of the powers that are given to them. Now, if you have bylaws that limit the powers and say those aren't part of the powers, then they're not. But if they, as long as it's part of the powers, Brazil thinks that that's reasonable as well. And I've given you examples where it would be, it sounds very anti-democratic and it sounds like you're singling out people, but let's suppose, for example, there was a time, if you think about, you know, the 1930s, and let's suppose for a second that the people who signed on to be brown shirts, to be part of Hitler Youth or Hitler's Stormtroopers, whoever Hitler's things were, and they were from a certain segment of society and they were going for this man, and let's suppose that the leaders, other leaders of the community could see where this was all going, and they said those people lose their right to vote by virtue of their willingness to support this. Rav Uziel seems to be saying, he's not talking about that in specific for sure, even though it's happening right around his time in Germany, he's not saying that, but he seems to be saying that that is something that leaders of a community should and could have the right to do. Just like today, the leaders of our communities have said that certain kinds of felons lose their right to vote. So it would be, there are ways where the leaders are empowered as part of being voted in to also alter who it is who can vote, and they have to do it. Gerrymandering to make sure they get reelected is a problem, but assigning districts or making rules about voting rules in a way that will improve the society, that Rav Uziel is in favor of. That also can be taken too far, right? The United States of America had a history of making laws that seemed like they were laws about people who were qualified to vote, but really were laws about excluding certain classes of people from voting, such as most prominently African Americans. That would be a problematic way to do it. So it's not, I think, Rav Uziel would be saying to us, that it's not the particular power that's the problem, it's the way the power is used. And either way that the power is used, it can be misused. Meaning, if you require unanimity, that can be a problem, because then people who shouldn't really be voting, don't really understand the issues, can get in the way of everybody else doing what needs to be done. Let's suppose a bond needs to be issued to do some public works project. And there's some small group of people say, no, we think bonds are never good and we refuse to do this. So if your rule is unanimity, and these people simply don't understand the need for a bridge or some... or a highway or some really well-accepted communal need, so that'll be get to be a problem, then you get it. It's not the power that's the problem, it's how these powers are used, and these choices are always going to be hard choices. However, when it comes to a communal decision or ordinance where one particular person is going to be adversely affected, it's almost aimed at that person in some way, there Rav Uziel says you might need all the elected leaders to be there, and they might all need to agree, or a supermajority. Right? Sometimes it'll be a majority, sometimes it'll be a supermajority, and then you might also need a Torah scholar to also agree. Meaning the role of the Torah scholar there isn't to say what should or shouldn't be done. The role of the Torah scholar, I think, is to say this idea that you've all had and you've all voted on fits within the Torah way of viewing how it could work, and he has, it would be more like a veto power than a voting power in that sense, that he would have to over this. And of course, if the secular government says something, then there's a dina de malchuta issue that we also always, and generally, not always, we generally follow the laws of the local government as long as they're well-made laws. That would also be part of the responsibilities of the leaders of the community. And then I hadn't realized the time, so I apologize. I'm going a little bit over. I'm trying to point out, then he carves out a huge exception because he says, closing up, before he re-summarizes everything we've said until now, but closing up, he says, all this is only about matters of citizen rights and matters of finances. But when it comes to education or kashrut or how to serve Hashem and how to have laws and court systems and all of those things where there's halacha and it has to do with Torah in a very direct way, in a very clearly laid out way, so then we're obligated by the Torah in the written Torah and the traditional Torah, and a community can't just decide not to follow that Torah. So in anything that touches on that, they're going to have to consult very carefully with the people who know and understand how Hashem's mitzvot work, how faith works, how tradition works, and they're going to have to follow all of that, and they're going to have to rely upon that. So Rav Uziel, basically, he has a maskana, he has his five conclusions. I'll just briefly say his conclusions are that basically people have the right to vote if they pay their taxes, if they pay whatever is required of them, whether it's a lot or a little, they have the right to vote. But once they vote, they're voting to give certain powers to communal leaders, and those communal leaders then have those powers which they can wield as they see fit, sometimes with the consent, I guess the advice and consent of a Torah scholar, sometimes on their own, depending on the issue that they're having, that they're talking about, and sometimes they have to recognize their expertise is the topic is outside of their expertise, and it touches directly on Torah matters, and then they have to go and make sure that it's people with Torah expertise and Torah experience who are ruling those issues. So, Rav Uziel, on some of the communal issues of finding leaders, choosing leaders, voting for leaders, and then the powers that are given those leaders, and which obligate the rest of us by virtue of the fact that they are wielding proper authority, and we, the rest of us, would be required to follow that authority. And that is a responsible day for the 13th of Tammuz, Rav Uziel, on communal authority. Have a great day.